Hello, and welcome to episode 60 of the Sci-Fi Podcast from Bloomington, Indiana. I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am very pleased to welcome Dr. James Jack Justice, Associate Professor of Philosophy and core member of the proudly boutique History and Philosophy of Science program at Florida State University. Before coming to Florida State, Jack worked as a postdoctoral research fellow at Sydney University on a project heroically attempting to integrate decision theory and environmental ethics. His research interests include philosophy of science, especially biology, history of analytic philosophy, especially Carnap and Quine, environmental philosophy, formal epistemology, philosophical methodology, and philosophy of mathematics. Jack is currently working on a book manuscript on the philosophy of ecology, as well as several papers, including three organized around the title Semantic Information in a Biological World, another criticizing the niche concept's role in ecological theorizing, another defending Ayer's maligned significance criterion, and another rebutting the charge that normativity challenges naturalism, among sundry others. Besides philosophy, Jack enjoys non-competitive birdwatching, raising progeny, usually, and attempting non-awkward interjections of aphorisms and colloquialisms into everyday conversation. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Jack. Dr. Jack Justice, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this Monday morning?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. How are things down in Tallahassee?
They're good. They're not too hot yet, and that will begin in probably 2 weeks.
Cool. How was the polar vortex down there? Did it get to the, negatives? No.
I mean, it was really severe. It got down to like 52.
Oh my gosh. Terrible. Wow. Yeah, you missed out on the negative 30 wind chill, actually, in the Midwest. Negative 60, I think it was, in Chicago. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Cool. How was the...
I grew up there, so I know.
Oh, really?
Feeling, yeah.
Oh, fine. In Chicago?
Downstate, so like 3 hours away.
Okay. All right. So you're familiar. You've experienced this. Know what it's like. How are things getting along in Tallahassee in terms of like the term... you know, teaching, research, stuff like that.
So the semester began 3 weeks ago or so. I'm teaching the two kind of standard undergraduate classes that I regularly teach, upper division philosophy of science and lower division environmental ethics.
Okay.
Environmental ethics, they pumped up the numbers of students to like 140 or 50.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and that doesn't really work with the way that I teach, but there's no other way I can teach, so I'm just sort of fumbling Socratically through.
Uh-huh.
I'm also coming off like a year sabbatical, so remembering what it's like to teach about a hard awakening.
I find that, yeah, even a summer off or some time off, it's like kind of having to get back into the work balance and just being in front of a class consistently. It's definitely a challenge.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's draining.
Yeah, no, it can be. Absolutely.
I like teaching, but I mean, at the end of a class, I just feel like wiped. I mean, just like they've extracted energy from me.
Yeah. Well, it's, I can understand. Like, even if, you know, you're performing in some ways, you're connecting, performing, And you're giving a lot of yourself, and that's different from other activities. Especially 140 person class. It's 140 students. That's a lot. All right. Well, let's get started and let's hear a little bit more about your story as a philosopher of science. How you ended up working in Tallahassee and the various paths and avenues that you've took. So you mentioned you were you grew up in south of Chicago. Tell us a little bit about that.
So I grew up in Galesburg, Illinois. It's a pretty small town, maybe 30,000. If you sort of take the midpoint between St. Louis and Chicago, and then on the perpendicular of that midpoint go to the northwest, 50 miles, you know, you'll be there. The river, Mississippi River, is like an hour away. Wow. It's famous for the birthplace of Carl Sandburg. Oh. Yeah, there's two railroad tracks that cross, and that was actually how the town got started. So it's a pretty...
30,000.
Yeah, 30,000. I mean, like, we weren't in cornfields, but, you know, we were like three blocks from cornfields.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I grew up, like, my mom didn't work for, I think, the first 7 years of me and my sister after we were born. And I mean, my dad worked for the state. He was a civil engineer. It was like, we weren't desperate, but it was like tight money times.
Yeah.
And I mean, the only thing I really remember from childhood is just mostly just running around outside, like, all the time.
Mm.
There's a creek down down the way. And I would just play in this creek, like, look for frogs, like, run around with, like, the neighborhood kids.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was like a totally different time, that's for sure, because I would remember, like, I'd leave after breakfast, like, during the summer, and we'd kind of be in a radius of the house, and I remember my mom would just kind of, she'd, like, open the back door, and she would just say, "Laura, Jack," here, and then we'd come back for lunch, and then we'd, like, leave again.
This is your sister, Laura?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. So yeah, it's like the open, what radius did you explore? Was this just like within a mile or something, or was this backyard or?
I mean, it depended on the age. And I remember I remember when I was really young, we lived on a dead end, mm-hmm. and I couldn't go past the dead end.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember for whatever reason, I think like the ice cream truck, you know, the truck with a little jingle.
You guys had a little ice cream. Yeah.
And I remember, like, I heard it and I wanted it so bad. I was on my big wheels, and I remember I, like, went around the block.
Uh-huh.
And I remember, like, as I was, and which is way past the end of the dead end, and I remember my, like, dad pulls up in this piece of crap, red 1980 Dart. Everybody pulled up next to me. He's like, "What are you doing?" Yeah.
Oh, fun times. So you make your own fun in a town of 30,000.
Yeah, that's right. It's a small town. You got to make it up.
Two railroads and a backyard. And yeah. All right. So, you know, spend a lot of time outside. Like, how did, you know, what did you see in terms of like your interests growing up? Like, yeah, what were you interested in? How did those things develop and change?
Yeah, so my mom, when she started working again, she was a seventh grade biology teacher. And that meant that, you know, as I went through school, you know, I'd never pursue biology because...
Mm.
You know, my mom's into it, and it's, you know, obviously it's stamp collecting and it's sort of not deep.
Mm.
And so, yeah, so basically like the model in high school was physics.
You know, right.
Steve Hawking. I mean, that was just like black holes.
Sure.
Yeah. So into that. And so basically then I in high school, I did okay. Like the high school was really, I mean, the school system wasn't great. Like our high school had no AP classes, zero.
Mm-hmm.
And you could take, like, the high school just sort of initiated by itself classes that were like a couple advanced classes. So, like, I took those classes, and you would take like a test once you got to college, but there was no like official AP designation or anything like that. And so, like, a lot of the teachers just, you know, weren't great. I mean, a few were great, but it's like there's a sort of mediocrity. You look backwards. I mean, when I first got to University of Illinois as an undergrad, I took, you know, the first of the the physics for engineering students. And, you know, a lot of these students were from the suburbs of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they had had this stuff. They are way more advanced than I was. I mean, I was just like struggling to keep my head above water initially until I caught up.
Sure, sure. No, I can relate. My own high school, it had AP classes, but it was definitely not. It's like it's interesting to then meet the other students in some of your more advanced courses in college and realize, wow, there was a different kind of or folks from Europe, let's say, who had secondary school in a European system. It's just like, oh wow, there was this other kind of educational style. And so maybe there's some advancements in certain areas, but then definitely having to kind of recoup some of that which you didn't get is sort of your responsibility as you kind of
grow
up. Yeah. But physics was the thing go ahead.
It was like engineering physics. So you're basically doing a physics major, but you're in the engineering school. I detested this course called GE 103 General Engineering, and it was just like the actual engineering. Like you had to learn about like screws and do drafting.
Yeah, like literally building and designing.
Yeah, like CAD stuff. I was like,
sure.
It was like the first B I got. I mean, it was just like I hated it so much. And so anyway, like I first like year and a half, I just did the sort of standard engineering/physics track, and then I finally got into like the physics for real physics majors classes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was I think dynamics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like relativistic dynamics, and it was like I mean, like we would get these problem sets, and it's like it was just not clear what the rules were for solving these things. Like, and the kids that would like found it so easy, they would just have this like intuitive grasp.
Yeah.
And so they just start, these cancel out. Well, we're talking about a friction, so we can just disregard this thing and bing bang. And then all of a sudden it's like, they've got the simplified understanding, and then it's just a straightforward mathematical problem. It's like, I just never could grasp like what the hell, how they had this understanding. And so, so basically I was like, I'm out of here. And I had taken all these math classes and I just switched to math because math is just so much easier. It's all just straightforward and explicit. It's like, prove this. These are the resources. The logical steps leading from this to this are transparent, and you just have to see the connection. It's not that there's no like this intuitive sort of understanding, which I just didn't get.
Yeah. Right.
So I switched to math, and for some reason I'd been taking philosophy classes like since the first semester. And I eventually got to the point where if I took one additional course, I think, and it was ancient, I could get a whole another degree.
Hmm.
And I wasn't going to do it. And I had this conversation with my quasi girlfriend at the time. And she was like, wait, let me just get this straight. You can get a whole new, whole other degree, and you're thinking about pursuing philosophy, but you're not going to do it because you won't take one class. And I was like, yeah, you
like when you put it that way. But
that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, geez. So did you cave? Did you take ancient?
Yeah, I took ancient. I got the degree. I had to. So when I was a sophomore, I think, I was pretty good at math, and so like they offered me to have this like job called a classroom assistant. It's like there was like a graduate student teaching a kind of remedial like algebra 2 sort of class.
Mm.
And then I was like the helper.
Mm.
And so I would run these like math labs. They would have these like group labs, and that was my sophomore year. And it was like, I mean, in retrospect, it was really lucky because within the first, definitely within the first 2 weeks, it was so clear. I was like, I want to teach at the college level. It's just, this is fantastic. There's just no doubt. I want this.
How did you know?
It's not one of those.
It could be, language might be difficult to describe, but like, what are some of like the values or like the things about it that felt like, this is something that I want to do?
I mean, on the one hand, probably primarily from my parents. I mean, I've just always been curious, loved science, loved learning things.
Yeah.
And then, so I'm doing that, in this job. And to like be able to like explain something to a kid and then who's like, 1 year below me, like explain it and like the person sort of gets it and just like the joy. Like the value of the experience just strikes you. Like there's like, if I can get paid for this, I'm doing it. Like this is fantastic.
Yeah.
And so I was 19. And then, when I made that decision about getting the additional degree, I think I was just like starting senior, year. And then I had to make a decision. I was like, well, am I going to go into math or philosophy? And that one was actually like, that decision was actually made. It's not really a decision, but it was just sort of it struck me. Like one morning I went into the math library at U of I, Altgeld Hall. And it's like this, it's really cool building. It's like a really great library. And the sort of main room's got all these like big legal tables and they're all parallel and they're divided by like these big shelves. And when I walked in, I had taken some upper division math classes and like, so I knew some of the math grad students and I walked in that morning and it's like, it's probably like 6 or 8, maybe these grad students. Mm-hmm. And each one of them was like sitting in an individual table and they all looked like they're about to commit suicide. I mean, it was like, like one person like staring out the window, like totally dazed, fried. The other person's like head is on their arm. Like the other person is just sort of like looking around. Like you could tell they've been up all night trying to like solve something in some class that I'm sure they had together. And I was like, man, I'm good at math, but I'm not excellent. And
right.
I'm going to end up, 40
doing
years.
This.
Not only this, but it's like, 40 years later, after like making it through all this, I will have proved like 5 things about some esoteric ring that 2 other people, can follow. And it has no sort of application to anything. Like, it's just so narrow. It's like, but philosophy is like so wide open. Mm. And it was just clear like in an instant.
Like, yep. Yeah, okay. Makes sense. Very nice.
When I told my parents though that I had chosen philosophy.
What was their response? Yeah,
he's like Midwestern. Like my mom, I remember my mom was just like, oh Jack, I hope you can get a job. And my dad's just like, he didn't even say anything. He just kind of like
didn't even say anything.
What are you doing?
Yeah, you tell somebody you do math, there's a little bit more. Oh, okay. Well,
yeah.
Right. If you don't, and I'm sure if you went on to describe like, well, I want to do like theoretical math or something. Our school here, I know a lot of theoretical mathematicians, and it sounds what you're describing like this. They haven't described the sitting at the table staring, bleakly into the middle distance, but I'm sure that is, experienced before. But there's something they love about it. I don't ask enough about folks who've, when they've decided to go into philosophy, how it is they're their family, you know, how supportive their parents are, how supportive the, you know, but, okay. So yeah. So you decided, made the decision that, you know, this is, clearly higher ed is something, that feeling of getting to, like really communicate ideas, see that happen. Like I can totally relate. It's a really wonderful feeling to do that. Despite sometimes then even at the top of our interview saying like, oh, I feel drained from teaching, right? It's like both, you know, I mean, like the things that we love, it's like both, it's not just like one or the other, but you're right. Yeah. There are those that, so anyway, getting into philosophy. How did you go about seeking out then training in it, deciding this is what I want to do?
So, I mean, I had no idea like what I was doing. I had these two degrees. I took the GRE. I did really well. The quantitative, I almost got perfect, you know, the math part. The rest was like high, but not like insanely high. And so it's like, okay, you know, throw some applications together. And like, I didn't have any real clear guidance from the philosophy department at University of Illinois. Is sort of, I've heard like, you know, obviously like much later people tell you stuff as a prof and even as a grad student, it's like that place is sort of dysfunctional at that period. And it's like, yeah, now I can sort of see it. So, I mean, just to give you an example of how dumb I was, I applied to, I don't know, like maybe 15 programs or something. And the writing sample, so I could have used like, I had a writing sample that was on like the adequacy of first order logic, you know, the Quinean, Davidsonian point to do mathematics and to do philosophy. And I had a paper like pushing against that, you know, I had something in philosophy of math, and, but instead of using one of those, which probably would have been great, I decided to go with a paper defending Marx's theory of history as my writing sample. And I mean, so I could just imagine like, you know, Pitt getting that and Cornell getting that. It's like, wait, this guy's like math and sort of very sciencey, but what?
I mean, this is, it could be philosophy of anthropology, philosophy of history or something, like, you know.
So basically I got into like two or three places, and the place that offered me the securest funding for the longest, and it was seven years. They guaranteed you 7 years. Was Texas. And so then I basically like went through the faculty and I was like, is there anyone that I could work with here? And I was like, yep, there's one. Like, so Drasarkar. And so basically that was the decision.
Was Colin Allen there at the time?
Nah, he was at Texas A&M.
Oh, I forgot he wasn't at UT. Jeez. Wow.
Yeah, actually I re-met him at Pitt, like, you know, last year.
Right, yeah.
And I walked January, whatever, 8th, and I walked into his office because he was the senior person at the center. And I was like, hey, I'm Jack Justice. You may not remember me. I last met you. And I think it was like 20 years or like 18 years ago, because I met him like that second year I was in grad school at a conference at A&M. He's like, well, you have to forgive me if I don't recognize you.
Sorry, I wasn't here when I was 22.
Yeah, that's why I chose Texas. Texas was also, at that point, it was a good choice because, you know, although I had this like math and science focus, I still didn't know kind of what I wanted to do. I kind of just knew what I didn't want to do. And so Texas could cover this vast areas. I mean, I was actually, you know, I was dabbling into continental stuff. Like, I read a lot of Husserl about logic. And so I was like, you know, this place is going to have the best coverage as well.
That's a really interesting point. So you got to do a little bit of analytic, a little continental, a little just kind of dabble in a lot of stuff. And they have philosophy of science as well.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Cool, cool. Yeah, so maybe you could tell us about how, you know, how you ended up going from, you know, wanting that this broad array of potential, you know, tools, methods with which to explore, and narrowing down toward a philosophy of science focus.
Yeah. So, I had a big interest in ethics initially.
Oh, nice.
So, but it wasn't really like first order ethics. It was like meta ethics.
Okay.
And there's a guy there who I really liked, and he was a really kind of inspirational teacher named Robert Kane. You may know him from like free will debates.
Hmm.
And so, I toyed with the idea of like working with him. And I finally got to the point where it was like, I realized there was sort of two things. Like one, I realized that like all the interest that I had in metaethics was entirely like negative.
You know,
it was just like a totally negative program. And I was like, I just don't think that this is going to serve me long term. You know, there's just not enough positive things I want to say, you know, and once I've said the negative things, there's not going to be more to it, you know, for me.
Yeah.
And the other thing I realized is that in terms of like the quality, and I have to say like the frequency of the feedback that I would get, and getting feedback at that high level that's actually like in depth and like sort of challenges you, I was going to get more from Sahotra. There's just no question.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of made the choice about working with him. And then I had to make the decision, well, like what, you know, what am I doing? You may know that he has really sort of broad interests.
Mm-hmm.
And he had taught this seminar on logical empiricism and that completely is in sync with all these, you know, disparate ideas and sort of commitments and dispositions that I had. And it really just sort of culminates like, oh yeah, like this is what I think is actually like the kind of best way of approaching both science and philosophy. Now putting like, you know, putting the linguistic turn and all that sort of shit to the side, just as a fundamental data-driven science is the exemplar philosophy, like that just immediately resonated with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could have either done something, you know, in logical empiricism, specifically like Carnap, or I could do something that kind of synced up with an interest in like the outdoors and the ecological world, but I'd never taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that same mom effect. And in the end, I kind of made the same decision as I did choosing between math and philosophy. It was like, man, I've maintained the interest in Carnap, but I just felt like there was just more possibilities, and it was so new and still is pretty new. And there's just so many things that haven't been explored philosophically in ecology that I chose that direction.
Yeah. What led to kind of the decision to sort of start doing philosophy of science, environmental ethics?
So, I mean, so the focus on philosophy of science, it was clear within a couple years of the beginning of grad school. It's like, you know, I kind of got a real taste of how, you know, standard core analytic philosophy went.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the logic parts, but I really disliked only later could I sort of diagnose as sort of the intuition pumping and reflective equilibrium tinkering. You know, I had this feeling in some sense where I was just like, I don't, you know, what do I think about this case? Like, I have no idea, you know, like, how am I supposed to answer this? You know?
Right.
And so like, it became very clear, like, I want to have a scientifically suffused project. I want, you know, science is definitely the core of how I'm going to do philosophy. And so then, like I said before, it's like choice between sort of more history of analytic philosophy of science as it's done by the logical empiricists versus, you know, ecology, environmental philosophy, environmental ethics, mm-hmm. a philosophy of conservation biology. And I chose the latter, and, you know, that just synced up with, I mean, basically my interest in like the outdoors and like, you know, how things are sort of put together in the external world.
Yeah.
That I'd never really like pursued seriously or taken seriously, partly because, you know, my mom was a biology teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned this interest in the you mentioned playing in the outdoors quite early on. Can you tell me maybe just a little bit more about your just general interest in the environment, and then what is it about a philosopher that can have something to say about the environment?
Yeah, so I mean, the outdoor thing, it's just like one of those things where, you know, there's not really like a cognitive sure. set of, you know what I mean? It's like, I just love playing outdoors. Fair enough. My mom, you know, she's a biology teacher, so she would always be like, you know, doing stuff that, like, I mean, from my wife's perspective, for example, it's just like gross and like sort of weird. Mm. Yeah, it's like bringing like, some, you know, some salamander home, or like, you know, like a bird, like a baby bird, like sort of figuring out. And just, I mean, she would just, it just, it, like, you see like a snake or something. Well, you know, do you recoil, or do you just like, whoa, cool. Like, you know, I want to grab that and like take a closer look. You know, that's like, that's exactly how she was. And it just felt, you know, just like sloughed off on me. And so it's like, there's no, I mean, you know, the elevator speech about philosophy of ecology and the environment, you can, you know, talk about things like, well, you don't really get a full picture of the biological world if you just focus on evolution. You know, evolution occurs in an ecological theater. Like, how do you even understand selective pressures if you don't understand the ecological dynamics that lead to them? With respect to the environment, you can talk about the fact that if environmental ethics is going to be a much, much more important domain of ethics in the future as the mm-hmm. consequences of us destroying the environment, or, you know, that, I mean, those are all, that's all true. But I mean, just to be honest, it's, I'm just interested in it. Like, okay. It's just the way it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I can do that, if I can do the philosophy of the thing that I'm interested in, it's just, I'm going to do it.
Fair enough. So the thing, yeah. So what kinds of questions then, if you really just like the environment for the sake of liking it, what is, you know, what kinds of things, how do you apply the philosophy to it?
Yeah. So then, you need to get clear about what the best science says. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, ecology is a super rich domain. It's also like idiosyncratically really well suited to my background because, you know, ecology, maybe more than you would expect, but it's a very mathematical. I mean, there are yeah. people that are just like field ecologists, but, you know, the theory is very sort of mathematically sophisticated and deep and intricate, and being able to like wade in to the math that's supposed to represent these ecological dynamics. I mean, that, mm-hmm. that was sort of perfect for me.
Right. Right.
So there's all kinds of questions about, I mean, just give you one example, like, a lot of the mathematics that's used, to model ecological systems, you know, a lot of those mathematics comes from physics. You know, you're using dynamic systems yep. modeling to. And the thing is that, you know, often the assumptions that are made that allow you to get that mathematics going, those assumptions may, I would say, much are more likely to be defensible when you're talking about a more prototypical case in physics, but it doesn't really, it's not as defensible when you apply it to the ecological world, just because the assumptions you're making don't line up with what's the case or what's not the case about these ecological systems. So as a philosopher of science, you can point out that, you know, some of the, you know, you can point out in a specific way that some of the assumptions that are made in these ecological models are assumptions that are not just like physics envy. It's just inappropriate application of a certain kind of mathematical approach.
How did you come to see that it was an inappropriate application? Like, what's an example? Because, I mean, this is interesting, because I find that we see a lot of these applications, I mean, in various sciences, from in systems biology, now in psychology, and some of these other social sciences, they're starting to adopt them. What was it about then? I mean, you then having understood some of the mathematics and the physics, what was it that stuck out to you as like these, there's something a little bit off about this?
Yeah, so just to give you one example, this is something that eventually came out of my dissertation. So you're using these differential equations to model some ecological system. And one of the things you want to know about this, about the ecological system ideally, and then and know about it via these equations is, is there a stable equilibrium for this ecological system?
Mm.
And this is often, you know, it's often, there's an idea in ecology, there's a sort of balance of nature, you know, things sort of are at this equilibrium point, or there's a kind of regular constancy, and thing, once they're perturbed, then they tend to back to that sort of reference state. And so what you would do then, using these differential equations, is you can apply these analytic techniques. And these are due to Yapanov. It's called Yapanov stability. And you can apply these techniques, and then you can actually derive when it is the case that you get a stable equilibrium. You can give estimates of the base of attraction of that equilibrium, and so on and so forth. And so one of the things that, I mean, you can only... you only appreciate the point, like, once you've sort of dug into, like, you know, what's required to utilize these analytic techniques with respect to this mathematical framework, you realize that some of the assumptions that are made don't really line up with ecology. And like, I won't get into the weeds that much, but
right.
In physics, you can make these assumptions that's kind of set a parameter space, that you're making assumptions about parameter values, and those assumptions, they don't change that much. And what justifies that in the physics cases is, you know, you have these background constancies, and those background constancies are just, you know, regularities of this, you know, sort of homogeneity of the system.
Yeah,
it could be based on like the fact that you have a law that applies here, like conservation of energy or something like that. But when you try and take those same assumptions and apply them in the ecological world, what's just not the case that you have that kind of constancy.
Right.
It's not the case that the parameters should be fixed if you're going to accurately represent the system.
Uh-huh.
So the idealization there, it's an idealization that doesn't look like it's harmless.
Sure. Fair enough. So you said that you translated a bit of this work into what exactly?
So I mean that was giving a characterization of stability.
Mm-hmm.
Was a long chapter of the dissertation, and then half of that eventually became a piece that philosophy of science accepted: ecological and Yapanov stability.
Very nice. Very nice. Was this sort of like your kind of like first sort of real meaty article?
It was like the second. like okay. a set of media articles.
Fair enough.
I had some earlier stuff on like loop analysis, which is this qualitative modeling methodology that Richard Levins, the evolutionary biologist, kind of developed. And I had a couple papers on that first. Those are like the first real papers, quote unquote.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. So it's, you know, you found your thing, your niche in terms of wanting to work on things. How did you then take it a step further? Like what became in terms of finding work and, you know, carrying on your sort of initial interest in a career in philosophy?
Right. So, I went out of the job market and I was very, very lucky that I first got a postdoc offer from University of Sydney.
Very nice.
And that, yeah, it's really nice. And it's basically a project funded by Mark Colyvan. And it was designed, so I can't remember what the government agency was, but it was a bunch of money. And the postdoc was to investigate an attempt to synthesize environmental ethics and decision theory. Hmm. So, you know, the way I think about it is that, you know, decision theory and game theory, more generally, it's the decision making methodology that is utilized in all these domains of decision making in our society. It's the rigorous way to make decisions. If you violate the norms, Dutch books and other irrationalities emerge against you. So if, you know, environmental ethics has to do with making decisions about the environment, which it does, obviously,
yep.
then it should be the case that it utilizes decision theory and game theory. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't, it seems. Like when you read through a lot of the figures in environmental ethics, they just pay no attention really to decision theory and game theory.
Is that just out of tradition, or what do you think?
Man, that's
who knows.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not the way that the discipline sort of emerged. You know what I mean? Like, you know, Leopold Singer, Callicott, Norton.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like that wasn't part of their wheelhouse. So. I mean, and in fairness, like, you know, the project was attempting to synthesize, and we got some great publications out of it, but it's very difficult to, like, put those two together. I mean, you know, like, environmental ethics, how am I going to, like, incorporate how am I going to rein in or, like, modify what the ethics delivers using the tools of decision theory?
Right.
You know, very, very different kinds of beasts, you know?
Yeah.
But it was still fascinating. Anyway, I had this, this postdoc offer, and it was 3 years of just research, which is sort of amazing. And then shortly thereafter, and before I'd like signed that contract, I'd got a tenure track offer from Florida State.
Very nice.
Which was, you know, TT, so it's the sort of real deal. And
yeah.
Then I basically just had to kind of negotiate between the two very deferentially. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it was pretty, it was maybe as optimal as you can get. I went to FSU for the first year. And then I went to, then they gave me a leave of absence for a second year. And then I'd been at Sydney before I ever went to FSU. So maybe I got like, I don't know, 18, 19 months out of the postdoc.
Oh, so you would accept the postdoc, but then you'd also receive the tenure track at the same time?
Yeah, that's right.
Interesting. Yeah. So, and that's what happens though sometimes. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was super, I mean, FSU, you know, they had and still continue to have a policy where if somebody has one of these external fellowships, they're not inclined to honor, to give the first year deferment.
Right.
And so that, and they weren't willing with me either. And there's a bunch of faculty members in the philosophy department that are pushing against that, because that's just, the policy makes no sense.
Right.
But so they didn't. So one of, so it was extremely fortunate that on Mark Colvin's end, he had flexibility with the money. So he actually, you know, had me there for 5 months before I started FSU. And then it was fine for him to not have a postdoc for that 9 months that I taught here. And then basically just sort of restarted once I went back. But if he hadn't had that flexibility, then I would have had to be in a position where I would have turned down at least a full year, a year and a half of research to take a tenure track job at FSU. And that, I mean, I would have probably have done it.
Right.
It would have been dumb. But I mean, that would have just been terrible. I mean, it just makes no sense.
Right. Hmm. So, yeah, so that's, so how did you, yeah, so, so tell me, explain a little bit again. So how did you go about then, you know, where were you working? So you worked for a little bit at Sydney and then went to FSU?
Mm. Yep. And then basically the second, the semester was out, like first week of May, I went back to Sydney. And then I was there for like 15 months or, you know, sort of summer, full academic year, another summer, and then back to FSU. And actually, when I went back to FSU, oh man, it was, Kim Strelny has this like workshop where it's people that are kind of his students and people that he has close collaborations with and his students, his students and so on. And it was like south of Sydney, Dolphin Beach, I think it was. And it's like, I don't know, 6 or 7 hours by drive. And it was like, it was 3 days. And like the last day was the day before classes began at FSU.
Ooh.
And so he invited me to come down. I was like, I'm not going to like miss that. And so basically like I had packed up like all this crap that I had in Sydney in like a just huge duffel bag. And I just left it at a friend's. I rented a car, went down there, like participated for 2 days, gave the talk. And then it was basically like I drove 7 hours. I picked up this duffel bag. I went to the airport. I caught the plane, you know, went across country. I arrived at like 8 in the morning, I think, on the Monday. On the Monday, after traveling like 36 hours or something. And then Tuesday was the day that I started teaching. Man, that was, you couldn't do that now.
That's amazing. That's, oh my gosh. So did you like your time at Sydney? Was that like going from having studied in the States and then doing a postdoc, having some opportunity, interest. Yeah, I've never heard of this situation, although given that they have a policy, this is much more common, I imagine, than I was led to believe.
Most places, I mean, just think about the logic of it. Most places that care, you know, are a research tier one place, the policy is, oh, we've decided this person is the person we want to hire. This person has this feather in her cap of a year of research. That research is going to accrue to
our
department. So we're obviously,
it would be foolish of us to like a lot. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the flip side is like, well, there's a worry that the person's going to like take that year. She's going to get a bunch of research out and then go on the market again. And then, you know,
right. Like, and sort of be a flight risk. Sure.
But, look, that's a risk you must take. I mean, you can't, like, that can't be the thing that guides the decision.
Yeah.
You know, you are tier one. You are a great department. You know, you are going to expect that the person's going to come back. And if they don't, well, like, that's just the way these things go, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, I mean, Sydney was an unbelievable experience. I mean, know, the level of activity, the people like coming, you know, it's like this international destination. So all these people from all over the world come and, you know, pay a visit there and give a talk and sometimes stay for extended visits. Like I played local host to Elliot Sober when he was there as like a distinguished international visitor for a couple months. I mean, it was just, it was fantastic.
That's great. That's great. So then, well, it sounds like a really good experience. What about, so in terms of starting your, you know, you're starting your tenure at, or starting your tenure track at Florida State. Tell us a little bit about that. Like how did you go about developing your projects? Were there any particular projects you were excited about that you carried over from your time at Sydney that you then went on to develop in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, basically like everything, you know, everything from Sydney has sort of carried over, all those interests and all the seeds that began there. I mean, particularly pre tenure decision.
Yeah.
To some degree, you obviously have to worry about, you're shooting for the best journals, but, and I'm it definitely is the case that I have a tendency to be a bit of a perfectionist. But pre tenure decision, you really need to like make sure you just constantly have a stream of things going out, getting evaluated, because you don't know whether you're going to have this string of like, oh, you just hit some crappy reviews.
Right. Yeah. Sort of.
You cannot afford to do that pre tenure. So basically anything and everything that I had, I submitted. And once I'm like, what, you know, post tenure, then you can like take a bit of a step back and potentially like broaden your interests. I definitely have tried to do that, but you know, you just don't have that kind of luxury.
Yeah.
Pre-tenure.
Yeah. Yeah. How was it communicated to you in terms of like what you needed to do? Like you've talked, you know, so it sounds like, you know, by the time you've gotten to this point, you have a pretty clear picture of what it is you need to do. How did you come about that? What kinds of sources and information did you listen to, you know, in terms of getting sort of the idea of, okay, this is what I need to do to be successful?
Yeah. I mean, our department has bylaws and the bylaws are explicit. And if I remember correctly, I think it was like they want three major publications, like, you know, in the best journals every 2 years. And that's now that, you know, they state that. They don't state that as like a minimum condition, but, you know, you should treat it for sure as a minimum condition, because like you just don't want things to be close at all.
Gotcha. So you really want like five or four or, you know, you're.
You do not. So basically like you want it to be the case that when your portfolio comes up, it's a no brainer, because if you get closer to the line, quote unquote, well, then all kinds of things that aren't really focused on your research can start emerging, you know. And once those things start emerging, you know, obviously the standards for evaluating them are not as clear. The perspectives of other individuals cannot be your own. And, you know, you just don't want to screw with that.
Right.
And so I got really, I mean, I, you know, they were very transparent the whole way. By the time that, you know, I came up, it was sort of like, I didn't have any doubts. I felt very confident. I mean, at least in the department's assessment. And that's the way you definitely want to do it.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty, that's good. Some good advice. So I guess, yeah. So it's, obviously, you have been successful in that. Yeah, I see you have a very nice string of publications. Any favorites you'd like to mention or kind of bring up to tell our listeners a little bit about?
Wow, favorites. I mean, these are all my babies, you know.
I'm going to ask you to pick favorites among the children of publications. This is just what we do. So, or maybe ones that have either, you know, you feel either have had the most impact in the field, or you feel like maybe have caused you to change the way of your thinking in relation to the particular discipline or philosophy of science. Or the content of it, or the philosophy of science in general, like taking on that project.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, if you gauge it in terms of impact, and you gauge impact in terms of citations, I don't know this because I haven't actually looked at sort of citation numbers, but I think at some point in the past, I got kind of tricked into going to into ResearchGate and having a profile in ResearchGate. And I think for sure that my most cited one of the publications is a piece that was in Trends in Ecology and Evolution. And that was one of the pieces that came out of the Sydney Time. And it was called Buying into Conservation, Intrinsic versus Instrumental Value. And basically the point that we made in that piece is that a lot of conservation biologists that have kind of philosophical dispositions, and definitely a lot of environmental ethicists, kind of viewed intrinsic value as, you know, the most important kind of value that's relevant in environmental ethics, and or the most powerful kind of value. It's a value that, you know, trumps in a way merely instrumental values. And part of the point of this relatively short piece, but I mean, I think it's a great piece, is just to point out that, you know, intrinsic value, it's not clear how that can get cashed out in, you know, the best decision-making methodologies that should be the ones guiding decisions about the environment. So decision theory and game theory.
Yeah.
And so it's just not clear how those kinds of values can input into some of the standard ways of doing decision and game theory. And the kind of value that does have a clear input is instrumental value. Because even though it's very difficult sometimes to assess like what the instrumental value is of this entity for other people, at least you have some way of tracking it. You know, so like you query some individual, how much would you pay for, or how would you feel that blah, versus these intrinsic value claims. It's like, you know, if I don't agree with you, what is the thing that you're going to say to demonstrate or to reveal that value to this other individual? I mean, you could just say like, oh, well, tough on that person, that they're just not in the know. And obviously I'm not talking to people that are just completely blind to the ethics. I mean, that has some point, but if you're in this, you know, you're in a negotiation between stakeholders, and the output of this, of the negotiation, is going to be some concrete decision that either will protect a bunch of the natural world or won't, or will to a lesser degree, then it's much more effective to offer them something that they can actually appreciate the kind of value it is. So, I mean, that piece, you know, has been cited all over the place, and obviously like a lot of people dislike. I mean, one of the points we also made is like, you know, people poo-poo in instrumental value, but, you know, instrumental value can be unbelievably deep.
Right. Yeah. So what are some of the main objections to its instrumental value?
Well, basically people caricature, often caricature instrumental value, just, you know, merely economic value.
Gotcha.
And so the idea is like, you're just one of these people that just puts you want to put a number on it. But
on the
we all know that putting numbers on things can often skew their true value. And we don't disagree with that at all.
Right.
But to think that then the only resort, given that clear failing, is intrinsic values, just to caricature and to much too narrowly construe what an instrumental value is. I mean, one of the points we make is like a lot of the work that's done by a lot of work that people want intrinsic value to do as a concept looks like it's also done by something like existence value. And existence value is just the value that something has to a valuer merely because it exists.
Right.
So not even like with respect to me looking at some glossy photos and beautiful documentaries of these things, but just, you know, I want that, even independent of that, like I just want that kind of thing to exist in the future.
Yeah.
And that's instrumental value.
Hmm.
So anyway, that's one of the pieces that's gotten a lot of press, quote unquote. One of the pieces I really like that I've written, that's not so weird.
Yeah, yeah.
is this piece that defends Carnap's last criterion of empirical significance. That piece I think is really makes a deep point that most people who have these like straw man-ish views of the logical.
Oh, this was the one in published in Mind.
Yeah. Yeah. That one. Mm. So it's basically like, you know, you read some of these histories of analytic philosophy and, you know, logical empiricists and these, we pat them on the back for their drive to make philosophy scientific, but they were thoroughly sort of confused and misguided. And one of the ways they were misguided is they, you know, thought that there was a verifiability criterion, or they could reduce all meaningful statements to a finite number of observation statements or something like that. Yeah. And that's just toys, those toy caricatures. So, you know, Carnap proposes something in the methodological character of theoretical concepts, this piece in 1956, that doesn't fall afoul of anything like the cocktail criticisms of Ayer's criterion, which I actually don't think are good criticisms, but the way it goes in these popular assessments. And it's a technical, you got to get into the logical weeds a bit to understand what the criterion is, but basically it just forges this way of diagnosing whether some term has a connection to observation statements, you know, just some kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And the criticisms that were made of it, and that not a lot of people paid much attention to it because I think the fashion was kind of changing at the time, but the few criticisms that were explicitly made of it and were thought to have like demolished the criterion, just like Alonzo Church's criticism demolished, quote unquote, Ayer's criterion, they just weren't great criticisms.
Hmm.
And so the piece just kind of shows how they're not great criticisms and how, as it looks now, this criterion looks like it's defensible.
Hmm. And how was this paper received?
It depends on who you talk to.
Yeah.
You know, people that are like work in the history of analytic that, you know, work on logical empiricists and
right.
And Carnap and Quine and Reichenbach and Hempel and so on. You know, they're like, that, mate, you know, great piece.
Mm.
You were the first to point out X, Y, and Z. And,
right, right.
But as judged by, you know, the non-responses from from people that would object to the line, you know, I have to assume they think it's, you know, yet more misguided theorizing.
Oh, geez. Yeah, sure. Very interesting. How have you balanced doing some pretty interesting history of analytic with doing completely not that with environmental ethics?
You know, I love that.
Yeah. Like, just shifting gears.
Yes. I mean, it is, mm-hmm. It's great. It's like, cause there, I mean, you know, there are overlaps. You know, obviously I'm taking kind of the same, I am giving the same kind of approach to both domains, but the domains are so different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like, you know, going through, you know, some technical stuff by Carnap or, you know, some technical stuff by Reichenbach or Hemp, you know, whatever. And like that kind of fuels a kind of a real love of like getting into the nitty gritty. And then also like dry in a kind of drier logical sense. Although I don't really agree with it's not dry, but you know what I mean?
It's a different kind of work and it's a different way of talking about things. And absolutely.
And so then you can just switch gears and be reading something about something in the natural world, like how trees, you know, tree distributions might line up with the neutralist. I mean, it's just like, it's great to be able to shift gears like that.
Well, one of the reasons I got into philosophy of science was that it seemed like you, for that purpose of the ability to shift gears in, or just philosophy in general, was that you can explore something in a particular way over here, and then you can explore something in a particular way over there. And you need not be so narrowly, based on like the discipline, you need not be so narrowly confined to doing this, you know, X, Y, and Z, just this. You know, you're not confined necessarily, kind of as you described in terms of, maybe this it would be a character to describe math, theory of math that way. But like, it seems like philosophy does provide a little bit more openness to doing different things.
I totally agree with that. And one of the things that's sad, I mean, it's not really sad, but, you know, intellectually it's sort of sad, is that recently, like, Michael Ruse asked me if Carnap had said anything, you know, of any sort of philosophical substance about biology. And he gives these sort of really, really simple examples when he's outlining the philosophical methodology of explication, but you know, they're really designed to just illustrate this methodology. It's not about biology. And so I was like, well, yeah, that's a great, like, do I know of any? And so I kind of systematically looked and it's almost zero. I mean, almost, it's not in his, it just doesn't care, I think. And it was sort of sad because it would have been great to have that kind of bridge.
Yeah, no, that would have. You said, so what is the closest that you found?
I think it was in the textbook, Introduction to Philosophy of Science. And I think only a few, I mean, I think he mentions one example. And then the only thing of any sort of substance that he doesn't really discuss or defend in any way is that he says at some point something that clearly entails that biology can have laws.
Okay.
You know? at least he's not disrespecting that. You know?
Fair enough. Yeah. It just wasn't at the time, of interest, I guess, to philosophers of science, or they weren't doing it as much.
I mean, it's a sad thing about the logical empiricist that, with very few exceptions, physics was the science, you know, to investigate philosophically.
Yeah. Well, tell us, maybe we can shift gears. Tell us a little bit about your, it looks like you have a book under contract with which you're working on, The Philosophy of Ecology and Introduction. How's this been going? What are sort of your plans for this book?
Yes, this book is almost done. Man, it's taking forever. so the book is kind of designed to be a biased introduction to philosophy of ecology. So when I say bias, I don't know whether bias is the right term, but the point of it is to give a survey of what I think are the most important areas in philosophy of ecology, but not a neutral survey. It's one where, you know, I take a line and, you know, give an explicit argument and sort of show that these positions on these topics are not as defensible as these other positions.
Yeah.
So in a way, I want to, like, you know, it's an introduction to the field, but it's also a chance to kind of, you know, become the whipping boy, you know, in the new subdiscipline. Like, I want people to be responding to the claims that are made in this book as they wouldn't if it was just a sort of neutral textbook.
Yeah. Fair enough. And is it basically going to be, it's an introduction. So is this something that, like, you know, a philosophy of ecology course could adopt? Is this a,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, yeah. So
like, I'm thinking the audience is upper division, undergraduate, graduate seminar. And, you know, there are some courses in ecology programs that deal with, you know, scientific methodology or philosophical takes on ecological issues. So this could be used for some subsection of those kinds of courses.
Awesome.
Or just, I want ecologists that have an interest in philosophy to read it.
Yeah. So yeah. I actually haven't asked you this yet. Like, what is your current, like, do you interact at all with working ecologists?
I mean, not as much as I'd like to.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started at FSU, like, I definitely, there was more interaction between me and several ecologists. It's sort of hard. I mean, I obviously go to some scientific meetings, both in conservation biology and ecology, but it's, you know, it's difficult to sort of maintain those sure. relationships.
Sure. Is there like an ecology meeting like you would consider going to, or I just know, yeah. So a lot of, you know, in sort of connecting with those, or is it more like that you would show your work more at like environmental ethics conferences, things like that?
The main one in ecology is the Ecological Society of ESA, America. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're really trying to, like, to make connections with ecologists that might lead to collaborations, you know, those giant meetings are really difficult way to,
right.
I mean, it's just not as conducive to face-to-face meetings where you know, actually bond and then get interested in some joint project. So for me, it's more like, when scientists, well, for example, at Ishkabibble, you know, when there are scientists that are there, or you can, it's a good example, as part of like a symposium proposal, you include an ecologist because you think that they'd be interested in presenting something that they have that might be philosophically oriented. Like, that's much more the case of the kind of ways you're going to get actual collaborations with scientists. Like, I think it was because of that tree piece I mentioned earlier and some other stuff that this guy in Israel, David Saltz, who's a conservation biologist, contacted me, and we put together a symposium for the Society of Conservation Biology. And we gave the symposium, and then his piece he wanted to do a little bit more with, and then he and another guy he enlisted as co-authors, and then that piece, for example, is coming out in conservation biology. So I think, like, that's much more fruitful, I think, way to try and establish those collaborations.
Okay. These smaller face-to-face.
Yeah.
Rather than, yeah. No, right. I mean, there's the big meetings, but you're right. This kind of baseline. Yeah. I like where you're going with this. Yeah.
I mean, it's something probably, especially post tenure now, like, I should probably start making more of those contacts here at FSU. I mean, FSU's got a real interesting history in ecology. It was the home of what used to be called the Tallahassee Mafia.
Oh,
in ecology, and they were like a group of individuals that were known for the really incisive and sometimes sort of caustic criticisms of ecological work that was done in the 70s and early 80s. You may know the name Daniel Simberloff. He was a member of the Tallahassee Mafia. And the whole null models debate in ecology, the accusation that inappropriate statistical modeling or statistical assumptions and methodologies were being employed to support a lot of these claims about, you know, island biogeography, competitive construction of different ecological communities. They were known for making very vigorous critiques of that kind of work.
Yeah, I've came across this it's a Daniel Simberloff, you said?
Yeah,
so Daniel Simberloff, Creative and Devastating, is the title of the piece. It's sort of like, I think it's like an ode or an honorarium to this gentleman's work. Yeah, okay, interesting. Yeah, so now post-tenure, so you're working on a book. I mean, you mentioned earlier like of potentially wanting to broadening out, or do you have any, what is sort of your trajectory, your now that you have been tenured for past few years? I mean, obviously you get to take advantages of things like going to Pitt, where we met.
That was amazing.
Yeah. what is your plan?
I mean, the plan is like, I'll finish this book, and the book has obviously caused a backlog of papers, so it'd be interesting to know whether this is true of other professors, but basically you get this backlog of papers that, it's not just a abstract that you constructed and a PowerPoint that you slapped together, but it's like, I've got the sections of this thing. I know the basic content of how the arguments are going to go in each section. Maybe even I've written a kind of rough draft.
Yeah.
But I've got like, six or eight of those. And it's like, I'm just going to keep working through them,
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fair enough. Got a lot to get out there. It's I've heard a lot of people talk about how, well, once they finish the book, they don't want to write for a while, or that's and I feel bad. I'm like, oh, so what's next? They're like, well, I just finished the book. What more do you want? And I'm like, I get it. Like sometimes you just need to take a step back, and then eventually, maybe in 6 months or a year, getting back to the papers with which have become backlogged, which I'm sure is actually a pretty common thing. Juggling.
I think he says in the autobiography that Principia Mathematica like broke his brain. Like he couldn't do logic at that level anymore. It was just like it broke.
That's amazing. That's really telling. Okay. Well, let's actually get to one of the final questions I have, which I've been asking many folks, which is, what do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
Good question. The biggest challenge. I guess I could interpret that whole wide variety of ways, right?
You could. Typically, I've been interested in more so like in terms of like disciplinary challenge or methodological challenge, as opposed to things like, quantum physics being the greatest challenge in content way. Or maybe for you, it could be like ecology, but I don't want to bias your answer too. If you want to mention something where you're like, we have to figure out these ecological models, that's the biggest problem, or, we need to understand game theory or something, that's also totally fine. So I'm gonna shut up and whatever.
I think the future for philosophy of science is really bright, and I think it's bright because I think that the focus on interdisciplinary work has the most promise for saving a lot of humanities. So I think that, I mean, this is obviously responding in a way where I'm focusing on like wider threats to academia and universities in general. But I think that the fact that philosophy of science can have these clear connections to sciences and actually contribute things that are valuable.
Yeah.
It's extremely, I mean, it's sort of, it's going to be indispensable in the future, and I think it's going to grow. I think the places where philosophy is going to suffer are the places that just have no connections.
Mm.
And as a matter of like, if I interpret the question intellectually, you know, the threat is really the kind of non-naturalist underlying philosophical methodology. But I actually don't think it's much of a threat. I just don't think when you compare the two, there's much to be said on that other side. So, you know, the idea that like pumping intuitions about some, you know, hypothetical thought experiment, you know, is going to reveal some deep truth about the world was maybe a default assumption or seemed very ingrained a couple decades ago, but anymore that's just, it's not, I mean, it could be, this is just a byproduct of where I'm at. FSU's got a lot of individuals that are very empirically focused. Pitt is obviously extremely empirically focused. But it just doesn't seem like that's, it's taken as seriously anymore. Like, and you can raise this explicit question, like, well, yeah, let's say I do have that intuition. What's the epistemic significance of that? Like, what is the story by which I should trust that as revealing something about what? Some domain of abstracta? As, you know, when you ask those questions, people now it's like they feel the pull of, I've got to have an answer.
Yeah. I mean, is there any, so how do folks typically respond to these, you know, what you're essentially saying, which is the non-natural methodology is maybe not in, it's just not going to be as relevant, or, well, it's relevant for, they might say it's relevant for different questions, or, sure. You know, I mean, or say like, well, actually, no, we're working on this stuff over here, but is that like a really an appropriate answer? Is that, I don't know. I'm trying to be the most charitable I can to then, you know, understand where others are coming from when they try to maintain these particular methodologies. And I also don't want to caricature them as well. But
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a piece, Carnap on concept determination, and you know, I just defend Carnap's method of explication. And you know, and it, towards the end of that piece, I just run this dilemma. And the dilemma is that, you know, let's say it is the case that revealing these intuitions does reveal something philosophically important. Yeah. And the question is like, well, that's an output. That's a data output from a certain community. And one question that has to be raised is, if that's of value, is that the best way of extracting that kind of information? And if the answer seems to clearly be no, that's not obviously not the only way to extract this kind of information. So then it's the case that that information has to compete, and it has to cohere with information that you would get from anthropologists, sociologists, cultural studies, you know, psychologists. So it's just one of many different ways of extracting this kind of information. And it's not the case probably that the information is going to always point in the same direction.
Right.
And so there's that. And then if somebody says, well, this is sort of special, you know, this is the information that should normatively compel us to characterize these concepts in these ways. And then you just ask, well, what's the basis for that normative conclusion? It has to be, it's not just that it's revealed to you. I mean, that's just a descriptive fact, let's assume. But what from that then yields this normative force? And Carnap with explication has an answer to that. But, you know, the answer on the other side seems to be something that requires a certain sort of rationalism, a certain commitment to something that goes beyond scientific methodology. And at that point, it's just, it's not clear what the basis is for that.
Yeah. Fair enough. So in terms of the challenge of, well, it's, I mean, what I heard and what I've interpreted you kind of discussing as we've discussed this question is that, you know, there's a bright future for some, maybe not so much for others, or might just have a more and more difficult time justifying what it is we're doing. And I've heard actually this from other respondents. It's sort of like the biggest challenge for philosophy of science, or perhaps philosophy in general, is just like justifying how it is, why are we a discipline? Why are we still a discipline? And how can we develop, or, you know, where do we want to go? Now, I mean, there could be always room for doing history of analytic philosophy or history of continental philosophy or just history of philosophy in general. But in terms of how it is we interface with other disciplines or just knowledge in general, that's a big question, and it's not always, it's not necessarily clear how it is we need to justify, but you know, according
it's sort of sad that we, you know, that is such an important or pressing need now to be able to justify, you know, these disciplines. Because if you don't justify them in terms of outputting more widgets, well, then what is the real point? That's sadly the times we're in.
I know. It'd be interesting to maybe talk to some other. I think I've read articles by other humanities folks who have argued against the need to justify or the need to, you know, I don't know. Perhaps we could talk to another discipline and find out how you dealt with this issue.
Right.
You know, there's plenty of other disciplines out there, not philosophy, that get the same kinds of criticisms, that are going through the same kinds of identity crisis. And that might be a little strong, but just trying to understand it, you know, where they fit, and maybe, whether we're asking the right questions in terms of why do we need philosophy as a, I don't know, is that helpful, or do we need an answer to that? Should we just be asking the question to help us better further along, you know, better philosophical discourse or something?
Right, right.
Yeah. All right, Jack. Well, we've taken up actually longer than expected, but it's been fun getting to chat with you and learn about your work and then hear a little bit about your origin story, your history. And there's plenty more we could chat
origin
about. But
story.
Yeah. Isn't that fun to hear about? I have an origin story growing up. Yeah. So it's been fun. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with or to mention? Anything about, you know, graduate programs or other words of wisdom or anything else that we didn't quite get to that you were like, oh, I wish we would have talked about that?
No. I mean, you know, to the syntax and the void.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again. It was a real pleasure getting to chat with you on this Monday. Best of luck throughout the spring. And yeah, hope to run into you again soon, hopefully at a conference or a workshop or whatever. But it was a real pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it.
No problem, Jack. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.